player and Baby Come Back, broadcasting live from more than 600 affiliates in North America. That's including Puerto Rico, Guam, and Canada. Hey, you're listening to Coast AM. Can't beat it. And we are live out of the iHeart Studios in Louisville, Kentucky from 840 WHAS. I'm Connie Willis. What is to come this next hour and the next 2 hours and then the third hour? Well, we have a top five UFO case that may be possibly solved. It's a new theory, and we're going to have an exclusive coming up here next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Connie Willis. Our guest tonight, researcher, author, John Ventry, Pennsylvania State Director for MUFON, joined by fellow UFO expert Owen Eichler, and we're here to discuss their controversial analysis of one of the top five UFO incidents. And it's an exclusive here on Coast to Coast AM, so the first time you're going to hear it right now. So, John, let's talk to you first. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good, good, Connie. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and Owen, just hang in there. It's always a little difficult with three different people on there. So, John, first of all, give me your background. Tell me who you are, and without telling the story yet, why you are here tonight.
Okay. Well, my background, I'm a multi-state director for MUFON. I'm based out of Pennsylvania. I have four states. I've had as many as seven. I was on the MUFON board for 3 years as an interim board member. Career-wise, I spent 35 years at UPS. I was a multi-state security and public affairs director for them for the last 26 years of my career. I've been on the Anderson Cooper Show. I've done seven TV series for about 50 episodes. I've published six books, and that's my background.
Wow. What's you're talking about Hangar One. Is that the show you're talking about?
Yeah, 19 episodes on Hangar One, and I think I have 24 or 26 episodes on a show in Pittsburgh called UFOs Over Pittsburgh that I write and kind of co-direct and host with the West Virginia State Director. It's a UFO talk show that we do twice a month, and it's on public TV, but it's great for MUFON to get the word out, and we have guests, and we Skype people in, and it's basically a UFO talk show that's on twice a month. So I've done, 24, 26 episodes with that.
Well, I have one question before I go to Owen. This is just kind of off with Hangar One. Someone had written in and said, hey, please ask John if there's another season of Hangar One coming.
Well, it's a good question, because I was at the MUFON symposium last week, and we got up with the producer of Hangar One. We had a MUFON night last Saturday, a week ago, and the owner, the CEO of Hangar One was there, and there was no announcement. I thought for sure there would be an announcement. I even put that in my book that I just published a couple of weeks ago, Case for UFOs, the chapter on Hangar One, where I give a lot of inside information over the two seasons, little-known facts that I had accumulated. I put in there, for sure I think there's going to be an announcement at the MUFON symposium. There wasn't, so
no, yeah.
I'm hanging on. The contract's up in December, and we'll find out. But
Welcome to network television, right?
there were a lot of long faces there, especially with the cast of Hangar One saying, what?
Yeah, well, I wish the best for you. I hope that it continues on. It's always a joy to watch that for me as well. So, Owen, I'd like to introduce you, welcome you to the show, say hello, how are you?
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. And hi, John, how are you tonight? Good?
Good, good, Owen, good.
Owen, good. Can you tell us, without saying what the story is about tonight, first, can you tell us who you are and your background?
Yes, I'm a retired engineer. I spent many, many years in industry, worked for Westinghouse a lot of years. Early in my career, I worked in the nuclear Navy program, civilian, and later in my career, I worked in commercial nuclear power and various other power industry products.
Were
and
you
retired
just
now?
And then now you're retired. I saw that picture of you. You look too young to be retired. You're just too young for that. John, let's let you start. Tell me. We've got a new theory here. We may have solved a top five UFO mystery. So go ahead, you take it from here. Tell me which one we're talking about.
All right, we're talking about the Kecksburg UFO case from December 9th, 1965. That's the one we're talking about.
Big case, big case. Now, tell me about that case already now as it is. Basically, you know, we know something came out of the sky, it landed. Military came, this was taken away.
Yeah, well,
nobody said anything after that.
Yeah, I guess briefly, you know, description of what happened was, you know, December 9th, 1965, something came across the sky over Canada, past Cleveland. Now, interestingly, it made a left turn at Cleveland and a right turn at Kecksburg, which meant that it avoided the population centers of Cleveland and Pittsburgh, basically, and worked its way out into a rural area to make its controlled crash landing. And, you know, when I look at that, it kind of reminds me of Flight 93. For those people who believe it was actually shot down, you know, it was after it passed Pittsburgh and where I live in Greensburg and got far enough out into a remote area, you know, that's where the plane went down, if that's what happened with Flight 93. But that's what happened with Kecksburg. And at 4:47 p.m., it was seen over this area. It was described as on fire, glowing green. It was also described as a four-pointed star, like something was burning in four points. It slowed down after those turns, crashed into the woods. There was no debris field at all because it was a solid object. It was arcing blue in the woods. There was a blue arcing. And the few witnesses that were able to get up close to it, they said that it looked about 8 feet in size. It was cone or bell-shaped, although it was half buried in the ground. And so that's basically the basic story of Kecksburg that's been around for almost 50 years now.
And how many theories do we have on what that is?
Yeah, well, there's four different theories as to what the answer for Kecksburg is. And those theories are that, you know, the first comical theory from Project Blue Book was that it was a meteor. The second theory is that it was the Bell Project, the Nazi Bell Project from 1945, or some other black military project. And other than that, it was Cosmos 96, which was the Russian Venus probe that was launched. And the fourth theory is that it's an actual extraterrestrial UFO.
So before we hear the fifth theory from Owen, what do you think right now, what as a MUFON guy and just as a researcher on your own, what do you feel about the Kecksburg case?
Yeah, well, you know, my feelings have always been that this case revolved around the way it made its turns. Because if you tell me it's a meteor, well, that's impossible. And I can tell you about each of the four theories why, you know, we could knock them out one at a time if you'd like. But
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So for me, I always felt that this case, you know, was wrapped around how it made those two turns and then slowed down before crash landing. And that means it's under some sort of intelligent control or it's being controlled. And, you know, to be told that it's a meteor, and that was the Project Blue Book explanation, that was the most ridiculous of them all, but that's the explanation that's on the books. And, you know, meteors obviously don't make two turns, you know, and they're not controllable. They don't start to slow down right before impact, although they do lose about 90% of their speed from the point they enter the atmosphere until they hit the ground. But, you know, I would say to the Air Force and Project Blue Book, and I'm sure other people have, you know, show me another meteor that you had officers show up and 25 armed military personnel and a flatbed. You don't do that for a piece of iron ore.
Well, even so, I mean, if you've seen a meteor, you know, any meteorite whatsoever, they are not smooth acorn shape and this perfect shape that everybody has described. I mean, these things are molten, you know, and holes and just big and heavy, and they would have made, you know, something that size would have made a big hole.
Yeah.
So well, I, know, it's just crazy. I don't know why they, it just kills me. So
well,
I'm sorry.
If you look at Project Blue Book, you know, every theory they gave was ridiculous, whether it was swamp gas or a or the, you know, the balloon theories or Venus or you know, Jupiter. They just had no regard for the public. They would say anything. And unfortunately, 3 out of 4 people will accept any statement that a person in authority makes. And that's a fact. That's been studied. 3 out of 4 people go with the party line. If a person in authority makes a statement, they believe it. And 1 out of 4 will start to question it. And,
you are absolutely right about that. That's in everyday life about everything. I mean, even when you go back to, like, the crop circles, I remember one of my friends, a very intelligent human being, and I brought up crop circles, and he said, no, that was already, you know, nobody talks about that anymore. That was debunked with those guys that had the board and the ropes. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you believe that? Oh, my gosh. That one story did wipe out a whole lot of people that were probably questioning it. So you're exactly right. You're exactly right about that.
Well, you know, Hitler said, if you tell a big lie often enough, everybody will believe it. And that's what he did.
Yeah. Mm. So the meteorite one, okay, then what, go ahead, you were going to describe the next one?
Yeah, well, the meteor one we can just throw out immediately because nobody believes that one, although that's the official one. But, okay, let's take a look at Cosmos 96. And Cosmos 96, that doesn't mean it was launched in 1996 or 1896. It was the 96th launch of that type of probe. So the thing with Cosmos 96, you know, NASA knocked that one out as an explanation themselves because they said that Cosmos 96 came down 13 hours prior. And I don't remember if it landed in Canada or out off the ocean, off of Canada, but they said it came down 13 hours prior. So, you know, just using NASA and the Air Force's own explanation, they've knocked it out. And even if you look at a picture of Cosmos 96, it doesn't really meet the description that the people gave of seeing a cone-shaped or bell-shaped object that was smooth with no seams or rivets. Cosmos 96 looks like your hot water heater. I swear to God. You know, it was about 10 feet tall. I mean, it had pipes and valves and knobs sticking out of it. It actually looks like your hot water heater hooked up to all the pipes and everything. So I don't think Cosmos 96 would have fit the correct description. And NASA said they tracked it, and it went down 13 hours earlier.
And what was Cosmos 96?
Yeah, it was a Venus probe is what it was. The Russians launched it. It was supposed to be, it was called a Venera probe. It was a Venus probe. And, you know, it's funny. The Russians made a comment that they believed that the Cosmos 96 struck something in space. So could it have struck the object that we're talking about, which we're going to get to? But it really... It was the wrong, I believe it was the wrong shape. You would have been able to tell what it was. And NASA, you know, they tracked it. And they said, and, you know, for anybody to think that we actually got the Cosmos 96, you know, the Russians aren't stupid. They're tracking it, too.
Right, okay.
They know exactly where it went. If we had got our hands on it, then there would have been a big international incident. So it couldn't have been Cosmos 96. The Russians weren't going to let us keep it. The important thing, though, about Cosmos 96 was if we did get it, we could have figured out the missile capabilities of the Russians based on the size and weight of Cosmos 96. We would know their rocket capabilities to launch a nuclear weapon. So it was important. And an interesting statement was made by James Oberg, who later became the NASA spokesman. Everybody knows who he is. He made a statement that NASA may have lied about Cosmos 96 and that we did recover it. But I don't believe that at all, because the Russians wouldn't have let us. They would have made an incident out of it.
Okay, all right. And the next one?
Well, the next one is that it's the Bell Project, which is the 1945 Nazi technology that was recovered under Project Paperclip. And That would have given us 20 years to develop it and test it. And the Bell Project was an object that spun and compressed red mercury, and it was able to defy gravity by 89%. So it was able to lift off the ground. It defied gravity. It started to emit radiation. As a matter of fact, what we know about it, the radiation actually killed some of the scientists that were working on it. It depleted the plants that were in the area of the chlorophyll. And, you know, so that was what the Bell Project was. It really, no one has ever really shown or come up with any working case that this was actually a working project, but you did have from 1945 to 1965 to develop it. And it was supposed to be a time weapon that really, if it worked properly, you could bring your troops right up to the enemy troops and they would materialize like Star Trek. It would change time.
Well, if you could do that, you could... Go ahead.
You could be standing in front of the enemy and fire on them, and you would just kind of appear. So it was kind of a time weapon similar to, you know, the one that was in 1943, the Philadelphia experiment.
Right. Right. Yeah, so if you can bring somebody up just like that, imagine all the other things you could do. So why even go that route with it, right? That's
technically, technically, you know, we know we recovered that paperwork, at least with Project Paperclip in 1945, so there were 20 years to work on this and develop it. So the Bell is still a theory, and I know Owen has some comments about the Bell. Owen, did you want to jump in?
No, not yet. Hey.
Okay, well, not yet.
I'm trying to get your fourth one out here, your fourth theory.
Okay. Well, the fourth theory is just that it was an extraterrestrial craft that came down. And the problem I've always had with that one is it wouldn't be a craft, not based on the size. It would have to be more of an escape pod because, you know, it was described as being about 8 feet in size and really wasn't shaped like a craft would be shaped. It was a bell-shaped or cone-type shape. So, but, you know, that is a legitimate theory that this was an extraterrestrial craft because of the way people described it. And, you know, there was one witness, unconfirmed, who claimed on a deathbed confession that he was at Wright-Patterson delivering bricks, and he saw the bell there, and they were bricking it in for some reason, and he saw an ET laying on a gurney, and his hand was sticking out with three fingers. There was no confirmation of that other than this one person actually saying that. But the ET explanation is very viable.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. And, you know, I learned a lot about this from Stan Gordon, of course. And this is his baby, right? This is his thing. And learned a whole lot from him on these different things and the theories and the thoughts. And so to hear a new one is going to be very interesting, and I'm looking forward to that. So, Owen, you hang in there, because we're going to be coming back to talk to you. Are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, hang in there. And, John, we're going to ask you some more questions as well of why you are a part of this and why you thought it was special enough to bring it to us, and we appreciate having an exclusive as well, always here. So the big thing tonight, if you're just tuning in to Coast AM, I'm Connie Willis talking with John Ventry as well as Owen Eichler. And we're seeing if one of the top five UFO mysteries has been solved. The theory on Kecksburg is coming up next here on Coast to Coast AM. Hello and welcome back to Coast AM. It's a wild world, that's for sure. Cat Stevens. Having a good time tonight, you know, when friends tell me that, oh, I'm going to listen to your show, and people on the west coast of the world, they're all like, oh, 10 p.m. is when it starts, that's cool. But people on the east coast are like, 1 a.m., what? Oh, I'll be in bed at that point. Of course, you know, I can tell my friends it's okay. You can become a Coast Insider. And then you can tune in. You don't have to be nocturnal, as we like to say. It's only 15 cents a day. You get the podcast, you get the downloads, and you don't have to miss a show whatsoever. You can be a part of polls and all sorts of great stuff. It's great to be a Coast Insider, without a doubt. We are discussing right now, so stay with us, the Kecksburg incident and a new theory. Has the one of the top five UFO mysteries been solved? That's coming up here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, and I'm one of the guest hosts on the weekend. Very happy to be here. I'm Connie Willis, and we are discussing tonight what could be one of the top five UFO cases solved. Let's find out here. It's Kecksburg that we're talking about. And on the line with me, I have John Ventry from MUFON and also Owen Eichler, who has this new theory. So, again, guys, thank you both for being with us. Now, John, we talked to you for a good while here and set everything up, right?
Yes, we did.
And we fixed your phone line, heard a little bit of noise there, so we got that taken care of. So, Owen, if you're still with us, let's hear what this new theory is.
You're so excited, aren't you?
I'm ready. We got an exclusive here. Let's bring it on. I've grown up with this story, you know, and to be able to be a part of it, you know, another theory is pretty interesting. And I know for John to be a part of it, it's got to be something, right?
Right. And John gave me an invite, sort of, in the last segment that I would like to talk just a short time about before I tell you about what I'd
sure.
like to talk about.
Absolutely.
The theory he talked about, which I have done extensive research on, which was the Nazi bell, it may have had an alternative use. I'm thinking after all the years of research that I had done on it, getting into the red mercury, I did my studies there. I also did my studies that it more than likely could have been a centrifuge, an early centrifuge. And that
now,
would explain...
Okay, explain that just so people doesn't go over their head like mine about a centrifuge.
That's okay. I was going there.
Okay.
A centrifuge is an instrument that spins at a very high speed, and it can separate particles from each other in a mix, so that the heavier, denser particles would spin out away, and the lighter particles would stay closer into the source of the spin. Would that work for you?
Okay, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Okay. And the idea would be, if they wanted to enrich their, say it would be uranium fuel or plutonium fuel, if they wanted to enrich it, they could put it in a centrifuge, and when they were done, they would have a higher concentration or a higher percentage of the nuclear fuel than when they started. And likewise, the construction of it, from what I've read, kind of reflects that that's one of the possibilities that would be done with it. It also would explain why there would have been workers and scientists that may have been exposed to high levels of radiation. Back in those days, they really didn't know a lot about what they were doing as far as protection, and nor did they care if they just had workers there, slave workers. So I just wanted to say that's another possibility that has a lot of credibility.
Well, your theory, before you get into it, were you a witness as well to this?
Yes, that's where I was going to start.
Okay.
In 1965, I was, and I am still the only researcher, true witness of the UFO flying through the sky. And I like to say the word flying because it wasn't dropping. At the time we had seen it, me and several other friends of mine in a small town called Irwin, Pennsylvania, down by the Irwin, Pennsylvania Turnpike for those listeners here on the East Coast, it came across in front of us for a stretch of 5 miles or so, maybe a mile away, and at that time it was moving at a very slow speed and never lost altitude, which was amazing. The color of it was bright green. Behind it was flames of, say, orange, maybe a little bit of yellow, little wisps of purple. And what was interesting is there was no tumbling. It was just a straight line fireball.
Right, right. So, which means it's not like a meteor would be tumbling, right? Or?
Well, it could tumble, yes, if it had uneven surfaces to it. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be something that would be completely out of control, like an airplane, a small airplane, or some other vehicle that's just tumbling through the air haphazardly. This had a mission.
Okay.
And so after all these years, I had spent many, many years researching it. I spent time in Keksberg, where it landed, working in the 70s. I interviewed, just in the course of my job, many people, including firemen and witnesses that were there. And that's where really it caught my attention to get into this and study it a whole lot more.
So,
and I've come up with, excuse me?
No, go ahead.
So that burning bright green color captured my interest. And as I studied it and thought about it a lot, you had mentioned earlier in the conversation with John about meteors. Well, most meteors that we know of have a high nickel content. They don't burn green, although there are green meteorites. I have seen them, green meteors, pardon me. I have seen them as well, and they take a downward path, a slope path. I'm sure you've seen meteors. John's seen meteors. Many people have. And for the most part, unless they're very, very, very high in the sky, they come down on some type of angle, which it did not do. So after all those years, I thought a little bit more about it and started researching some more and found out that the only element I know of that burns green in the open air or incinerates is copper. And that's where I began my research.
And that's what I've heard with a lot of people, that they did think it was copper and it looked like copper. Okay, so what have you found?
Well, then after that enlightenment came, I started studying every aircraft, satellite, rocket, everything I could to see if I could find up something that was made of copper. And then I come across a General Electric designed re-entry vehicle called the Mark II. And basically, the Mark II was a blunt body re-entry vehicle similar to a funnel. On the back end of it would be a cone shape. The front end of it would have been not quite flat, but a little, rounded plate, like a pie plate. So what you have is something that's flying forward through the sky. That pie plate section of it is a heavy copper plate that, as it goes through the atmosphere and heats up, it'll burn that green color. And as I studied more and more, I found out that GE made many of these, and they were used first off on the Thor, then the Atlas, then the Jupiter rockets. These MK2 reentry vehicles were originally designed to house a W-49 nuclear warhead capable of 1.44 megaton TNT.
And that's what you think that is?
Well, we don't think at this time that it would have been a nuclear warhead, because it had a dual purpose. The reentry vehicle could also carry a film capsule, which is what everything that we've looked at lately, John and I, we've determined that it is and was carrying a film capsule. And we have documentation on a program called Program 437 that was initiated by the Air Force. And our reference comes from a Major General Paul T. Preuss, Deputy Chief of Staff, in which, and this was declassified May 6, 1991, this particular document outlines exactly what the mission of Program 437 was. And that mission was to use the MK-2 on Thor rockets that they could launch into space and take pictures of and plan to destroy another country's satellite with either conventional explosives or possibly a small nuclear weapon.
So that's how you can say it would be that one as opposed to the other, because on impact it could have blown up, correct?
Well, it might not necessarily have blown up. As a matter of fact, there really wasn't anything left of the debris field, like John had mentioned, because it was a blunt-bodied object. We're not ready to say that it would have been a nuclear device on board because of the time period. There were 60 of these MK-2 warheads and Thor rockets shipped to England. I believe it was in 1959, according to my sources, under a project called Project Emily. This was out of Vandenberg Air Force Base, where Vandenberg sent a whole team of engineers and Air Force personnel to set up the 60 rockets in England and train the people in England, the RAF, to operate them and use them against the Soviet Union. After 1963, those missiles were removed by order of President Kennedy. This was a deal that he had with Khrushchev as to settle the Cuban Missile Crisis. Those missiles came back to the United States, and at least four that we know of were launched from Johnson Island in 1965. So we have it narrowed down to four missiles with this warhead on. That coincides with the declassified document we have for Project 437, which was the photographing of enemy satellites in space, of course, with the potential to destroy them.
Well, what about the fact that everybody says it was seamless?
That construction would have made it look seamless. The heavier part, the blunt end of the MK2, obviously was copper, but the back end of it was a stainless steel cone. We found documentation that shows that it was copper cladded, and on top of that, it was coated with platinum. And there are seams to it, but they're very, very small. The seams would have been filled up with any of the cladding and any of the coating, the platinum coating. And it was dark, so I'm not so sure that people would have been able to tell for sure if it had seams or not. And we do know we have witnesses that have said, some have said seamless, some have said there were seams.
Okay, well, you sent us some pictures here that we have up on the website, and there's a capsule. Is that what you're saying, that's what it was, what's on our website?
Yes.
Because on there, I see a lot of rivets. I see a lot, and I'm not trying to dispute either way. I'm just, trying to go with what the witnesses said of no rivets, no seams, copper looking all the way through, and look like one molded piece, where the picture I'm looking at that you had sent looks like multiple pieces and seams and rivets.
Yes, it does. It kind of gives you the idea there may be a discrepancy in the story. But don't forget, that one that I put up on the Internet is a unflown model. It wasn't ready for flying at all, and it's just a display.
I gotcha.
Okay. Connie, it's also sitting in a holder that they would use to lift it, so that bottom piece there would not be part of it. That's sitting in a holder, and you could see like a little ring there that they would, chain right up and lift that piece up. So that part would not be part of it.
Right, and I want listeners out there to be sure to go to coasttocoastam.com so you can see the picture that they're talking about, and we also have a sketching there as well, so to go with Owen's story here tonight. So, John, what do you have to say about what Owen is saying? Thank you very much, Owen, unless you want to say more before John comes in here.
No, go ahead, John.
Yeah, John, what are you thinking there, Mr. MUFON man?
Well, I tell you what, when you look at this object and you look at the sworn deposition by Jerry Betters, who was one of the people that saw it up close, and he made a drawing that shows a U.S. Army flatbed with this cone-shaped object sitting on it. And when you take the picture that we have and you take his drawing and you just look at it, look up, look down, look up, look down, it's the exact same thing. Now,
and you're talking Jerry Betters. He was a musician, right?
Yeah, he was a musician here in the Pittsburgh area, and he was living in this area at the time. He saw it,
and he went down to the area. He saw it on the flatbed, so he was one of the witnesses that saw it up close. But when you take the picture that we found on the internet of what this, and it was really hard to find pictures of this. It was amazing. There were very few pictures of this GE Mark II reentry vehicle out there that we could take a look at, and there's even none in museums. Mm-hmm. We had some NASA contacts we had, and there's none in the museum to take a look at either. So when you look at the picture, and then you look at his drawing of a sworn deposition, it is the same object. The only difference, it's exactly the same shape, and on the drawing there is some X's and O's and lines on the base that some of the witnesses said looked like some hieroglyphic markings that were on the base. But it's exactly, you can't look at the two pictures and say that's not it. That is it.
So, Owen, what would you say to that with the hieroglyphics on the bottom? A lot of people did say that. It's hieroglyphics. There's no question about that. So how would you explain that with your theory?
Well, my explanation, as best as I can come up with, based on my experience with the nuclear navy and working with metals and huge pieces of equipment being shipped different places, they would have to have some way to identify it. Keep in mind, these were put together, designed and built by GE, and then they were given to the Air Force. That would have gone to Vandenberg. They're going to have to check in and mark it. Obviously, they don't want markings on there that somebody could see where it came from if it landed somewhere where it shouldn't have, like Kecksburg. Then they were shipped to England. Now they're going to have another marking there. And then they're shipped to Johnson Island. They'll have another marking there. Then there's a whole series of markings they would have to put on to say whether or not it contained a nuclear device, what size, how about communications. You know, what if there are particular radio frequencies they want to use to communicate to it? There's different versions of it. So there's plenty of places all the way through this string of delivery, recovery, for these things to be marked in some way that no one else is going to be able to figure out. And I've always felt somebody has a little code book in their pocket with what these little codes mean.
Oh, that's quite interesting. That's interesting. So thank you very much. Joining us tonight, if you're just tuning in to Coast to Coast AM, we're talking with Owen Eichler and John Ventry. John is with MUFON, and Owen has come up with a theory on Kecksburg, and it's the number 5 theory as we know it now. And we're going to hear more about how he came up with it, why he came up with it, and what John feels as a MUFON and what they both researched, and any other evidence they have to say this is it. So stick around with us. We'll see if we have one of the top 5 UFO cases solved with Kecksburg here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll also be taking your phone calls later, too.